Life changes, and the city's an organic place. And my guest, Lisa Haynes, and I grew up together in Old Town in the 60s. And Old Town, in some ways, Lisa, it hasn't changed at all. I mean, except for the hipper look of the people and the better jobs they have.
It's a time capsule, isn't it?
It is.
And down here, there's just building after building after building.
So this is a big deal, I think, for you to be in the last, what may or may not be the last broadcast out of here. When we grew up, we grew up in I think, what is a kind of relatively bohemian area with bohemian folks who prided themselves on loving words and loving music and loving certain kinds of freedom, some of them a bit out there, but most of them really good ways to live. That had to inform you as a writer, give you a certain foundation. It did me, though I certainly didn't think about it at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, just the idea that to be a journalist was to explore very deeply, and you wouldn't allow anyone to limit you. And my mother, in particular, was very confrontational with people like Mayor Daley,
and politicians.
The first.
Tell people what your mother did, Virginia.
So she had a column in the Chicago Daily News for a few years in the 60s. And before that, she was with Chicago's American. And that's where my stepfather, Norton Kay, he started out. Well, he actually started out on the City Bureau, I believe.
City News Bureau, yeah.
Yeah. And so and then he was the political editor. So I remember walking into the newspaper all the time and going into the city room, hearing the sound of the typewriters, going down and watching the presses roll, sound, that thunder.
It was it's very easy to over-romanticize it, but for two people like us who are newspaper kids, it's not over-romanticizing.
Oh,
the sound of a typewriter, which I sometimes hear in my sleep, is, I literally think, the first sound I ever heard.
And as a little girl, we would be in a big booth in McConnell's, which I don't know if that's around anymore.
Yeah.
And all the reporters smoking and drinking and having burgers and
See,
so on.
See, those were the good old days, the smoking and drinking part of it. I did, in a piece I wrote today in Sunday's Tribune, I literally thought, because now this tower that we're in is going to be filled with people who have much better jobs than a reporter, editor, writer, who can afford million-dollar condos. And I have one of my fantasies is that one of them will wake up in about 4 years out of a deep sleep and go, "Oh, my God, honey, I smell cigarette smoke. I smell cigarette smoke. We got to get out of this building."
They can watch the tea on the Trump Tower drop to the ground.
Well, see, the Trump Tower is built on what was the Sun-Times Daily News building, and this place did house what was the Tribune and Chicago's American, which changed to Chicago Today. When did you first start to write, Lisa?
I don't recall a time when I wasn't making
writing
up poems and songs and little stories. And I think I remember the first time I could tell a 3-sentence story.
What was
and
it?
That was just elation. I don't know, something about the spring or something. And I think I was 9 when I wrote my first novel. It was about a cat.
Yeah.
And I took the typewriter that my parents worked on and put that green newspaper print.
Sure. When did you then, we never really fell apart emotionally, but we fell apart physically, and you went away to college, and when did you get it in your mind that you wanted to be a writer? In a serious way. This could be my profession.
Well, I began in poetry, really, in college. And, I wrote forever, but that was when things really kind of took off. And I was aware that I might never make anything out of that.
Because
how many poets can really support themselves at all, right?
There are many poets who can't even buy themselves a drink.
So it was after college and working in my own little garret that I finally said, I definitely want to write a novel. I want to see what I can stir up, and that novel is buried somewhere.
Well, but your first novel is not buried, and your first novel, In My Sister's Country, it was a revelation to me. I have really, not just because we're old and dear friends, I have loved all of your books.
Thank
I even
you.
Loved Girl in the Arena. I want to talk about it, even though it's like a young adult book about girls, mostly. You were teaching, too, and you've been teaching for some time.
I have, and I started out teaching in City College Extension and so on. I've taught almost every age, and I've been now at Emerson since 2002, and then I stepped out for a year. I taught at Harvard, and I'm back at Emerson.
What do you get? I taught once. I taught a reviews and criticism course at Columbia, and I thought, first of all, these kids shouldn't be writing, and second of all, I shouldn't be teaching. It was a perfect double combination. What do you get out of writing? I would think there is something that a writer gets, because you're hearing other ideas. You're every day in a nurturing idea factory.
It's such a mix of things. At Emerson, they're very emo, and they're very diverse. In many ways, and they're, especially with gender, we're known for that. And then they're talented. They're just talented. Now, that doesn't mean everyone is a great talent.
Yeah, sure.
But when you find those talents, you really enjoy nurturing them. But I love the classroom. I'm sort of a sit-down comic in the classroom. I try not to get into too much trouble. And we talk about everything. We talk about movies. We talk about art. We talk about life, what's going on.
See, I think that's a really healthy place for a writer to be. Lisa's going to be here for this entire first hour. The title of her latest book, and I just love this. I'm going to read portions of it for you in the second half hour, is When We Disappear. Just published a really haunting cover. Much of it takes place in the city of Chicago, and a bit of it in a cemetery between Chicago and Evanston. I'm going to read a portion of that. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back. I'm talking to Lisa Haines. We are getting into, she's talked to you about teaching. We've talked about growing up in Old Town. We've talked about being scions of a journalism families. Her first book, how empowering was that, not just to get it published, Lisa, but to finish it? I mean, it is not an easy thing to write a novel. And the first one was In My Sister's Country, which I loved.
Thank you. So I'm so driven. I have to keep going. And in fact, the second novel that was published,
Small Acts of Sex and Electricity, which is a great title. Great title.
Thank you. So that book, I had the entire book written, and then I thought, this isn't really working, and I knocked it down to one chapter and started over. So that gives you a sense of how crazy I am.
Of your driven,
yes,
driven
yes.
nature. This is a very, very, very wicked time in the publishing business.
As
you
know,
anybody in the publishing business knows that the average consumer may not, or the people down it. How was your crowd yesterday? Lisa was a member of the Litfest gang of authors, the Printers Row Litfest. How did you find that? Did you find the whole scene kind of encouraging?
It was wonderful to see so many people out in the streets, and the classroom that the other authors and I were in, it was packed. Except it was about female desire. And I guess there were a couple of guys who wanted us to really talk about sex.
Did they really? They thought Stormy Daniels was going to be there.
And they got up and left.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not.
They thought the topic was female. Not female desire is represented in fine novels, but just female desire.
Right.
So they thought they were really in a classroom. We're going to learn all about it.
Yes.
Oh, that's something. But it is something to see. I mean, it gives one a bit of hope
about this
Absolutely. strange business. Now, When We Disappear, from which I'm going to read later in this, it's gotten some amazing jacket quotes, as we say. Robert Olin Butler, who won the Pulitzer Prize for a collection of short stories in, I think, about 1993, wrote this: When We Disappear is a remarkable novel that does what only great fiction can do. It explores the profound interaction between our individual inner lives and the outer world, particularly that most immediate and influential corner of the world, family. And great fiction this is. Lisa Haynes has long been one of my favorite writers. When We Disappear reveals her at the peak of her prodigious power. When you send a book to someone like Robert Owen Butler and say, hi, would you read my book and possibly give me a jacket quote, and that comes back, what's your reaction?
Well, you start out and you ask first before you send the book.
Yeah.
And you're in heaven. You really are in heaven, right? And Tom Perata.
Sure. Tom Perata says is a little shorter. When We Disappear tells the story of a family in a country fallen on hard times and burdened by the weight of the past. Lisa Haynes is a novelist of great empathy and penetrating insight. Yeah, that too works. And then eventually you can put Rick Kogan and say, this is a great book. Once we get deeper into the book, you can go... Lisa's daughter, Sienna, has created a website for her, and it is Lisa Haynes, LiseHaynes.com, where you can buy all of her books. Before we end this half hour, Girl, you told me about Girl in the Arena long before you wrote it, and I was ever curious, what drew you to a young adult novel after two very adult novels?
It was written as adult, and the market was really good for young adult, and I had a young protagonist, and that was it. I really didn't change the work to suit the market.
But just how they wanted to market this.
Yes, it was an alternate reality. It's the idea that now we have gladiator sport as big as the NFL, and not the safe gladiator sport with batons and cargo nets, but the real thing. And it's a dark satire. And for some reason, that just hit the market at the right time. Hunger Games, we were writing... She was writing Hunger Games while I was writing my book.
Do you feel like, Lisa, even as accomplished as you are as a writer, as a kind of pawn in this, since you've started, we were talking about this before we went on, in the era that you have been writing, you started writing at an era where the publishing business started to get crazy and crazier and crazier. Simply getting a book published, yours is being published by Unbridled Books, is an incredible accomplishment. Do you feel, in a sense, kind of up against it as a writer?
Oh, sure. I think we all do right now. And you have to believe in yourself so much. People always ask you, what kind of advice? And that's part of it, is to believe in yourself and to do the work, to show up for the job.
Now, the kids in your writing class, are they all aspiring novelists, or some, never having gone to college or taught college, what do I know? But they can't all be aspiring novelists, short story writers, or poets. They may be taking it for other reasons.
Right. Sometimes I get somebody who's actually in the film program, visual media arts, and somebody from communications and so on. And they just want to brush up their skills about story. Because even though we're shifting more to a visual world at this point, it's still reliant upon story.
Oh, no question. Yeah, no question.
And so you have to hold out the hope that those stories will keep getting transmitted in a variety of ways, including books.
There are, in this book, When We Disappear, a number of, if not a lot of different ghosts, a number of kind of ghosts and people thinking they see ghosts. What's it like when you come back to, you don't come back to Chicago enough for my taste, but when you do come back, there have to be ghosts here for you too, aren't there?
Well, right now for me, probably more than anything, it's my stepfather, Norty, and...
To whom the book is dedicated.
Yes, and I just ache from missing him. He was a real giant in my life. So I see him everywhere. I think about how he would respond to things. How would he respond to the world as it is right now?
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. And
well, he was a very smart, as was your mom, a very smart guy. And
your parents, too.
Well, and they were all kind of sophisticated in the ways that the city works and that politics works and that, in many ways, how, how life works, I think, also.
I think so.
And that's one of the things that distinguishes your book there. It is a, you know people. I mean, you know certainly these characters in this book, and you're able to bring them to life. And I think that goes a long way to, as we started this half hour, to the way in which we both grew up in a lovely sort of feeling. I don't want to make it too touchy-feely, but it wasn't that way, because they could all be sharp-tongued, all of
sure.
these people, too, and tough about, and no BS about the way life
Absolutely.
Was and the way life treated them. We are going to dip deeply into When We Disappear after some commercials and the news, so please stay tuned. Again, you can go to Lisa's website, LISEHAINES.com, and you can start ordering her three previous books, and then by the time you've done that, we'll be back, and you can learn about this one and then order that at the end of the show. Alan Barkas for musical bumps today, because he's a talented guy. Lisa Haines is here, and we have gone through our childhood together in Old Town, our families in the journalism business, her teaching at Emerson and Harvard, and now we dip into her latest novel, which has just been published. It's called When We Disappear. It is, you have taken a real risk here, I think, but pulled it off, by having two first-person narrators, a, I think, 17-ish
yes.
year old daughter named Mona, and a father named Richard, who is not present in Mona's life. That is a fascinating. Was it fun? Because you create, I know them both, having read the book. I really do know them.
That's great. I began with Mona, and I wrote that whole section out first, and then I just decided that I needed the father. So I was trying to figure out, how am I going to distinguish their voices?
Sure.
Because I understood who they were and their different attitudes, but how was I going to? So every time I would hear Richard's voice, I would imagine he was speaking in an Irish accent to just give it a different rhythm.
I'm going to read, much of the book is, there's a kind of down-and-out nature to some
yes.
of this, especially with Richard's life. Here, just, and it gives you an example of what a stylish writer Lisa Haines is. This is one of the Richard chapters. I didn't have enough to rent another place, but it was a mild winter. I lived out of a backpack I got at a second-hand store. I bought a cheap sleeping bag and pad, and I used the alarm clock on my phone. Most nights I walked until I found a safe spot to shut my eyes. Some nights I spent in laundromats. I thought of Mona sleepwalking at night, wondering what she was trying so hard to find, scared half to death that she'd leave their apartment building in her sleep. Before I left Newark, he's in Newark, New Jersey, I got more of her postcards, terrible images that kept me from getting any rest. That's really awfully good writing. I mean, just from those two paragraphs, you really know Richard. You're a teacher. What do you call it? Sort of the book turns on an accident. Sort of a turn is not the right word.
It's that one big event.
Yeah.
Especially in her life. And so there's been a hit and run. If I tell too much about it, I'll
yeah,
give
right,
it away.
Right, yeah.
But you know who came in handy in writing this was, what was his name? Governor Lobovitch?
Lobovitch.
Okay. Because he's the as bad as the guy was, he changed the statute of limitations.
That's right.
And took them off so that anyone could be prosecuted for a hit and run for forever, really.
Forever. And
yeah.
Now our great president is about to probably let him out of jail. What, when you say you were writing the Mona, you were creating this character
yeah.
of Mona.
Yeah.
And then tell me, Lisa Haines, how then did the novel start to change? Did you hear a story? Did you remember something?
It's usually for me, it's in bits and pieces. It's I hear a phrase or I see an image, and then I start going from there. And essentially, I'm living in a fictional dream. So to me, I have very, very vivid dreams. So it is as vivid as my waking life and walking around, and it's as vivid as my dream life.
Hmm.
So I feel like I'm inside these characters and with them, in the room with them, breathing with them.
One of the other hallmarks of your writing is you do research, and it shows, because the factual nature of what's going on here is so seamlessly tied into this. Much of when you're researching, like, what can go wrong with a car, like what things happen with a car, that's really this day and age. You don't have to go talk to a mechanic. You can just sit down and Google things that you need to know. But when you were dealing with your own memories, and a lot of this book is set in Chicago, it becomes a real different thing. You almost, and I get a sense, though we done the intimate journey here, that you revisit some places that you may be writing about to get a sense of them. Do you or do you not, or am I just...
No, absolutely. And sometimes that defies your research. So I was... The first place that I ever lived was on Juneway Terrace in Rogers Park. And when my mother was pregnant with me, she looked out at the cemetery.
Yeah.
And that same area is where I had a boyfriend later, and then my stepfather lived in that area. It's just I keep circling around, just like Crilly Court. It's a pivotal place in my life where we lived.
Sure.
And when I realized I was setting the book there, I went back and I drove around and I went, oh my God, they've taken out these old rickety wooden supports for the elevated train. And it's all concrete now.
Yeah, yeah.
But I couldn't give that up. So though I knew it was concrete, I set it in current day with those old wooden supports because I had to hear that clack that it made.
Yeah.
And I had to see that someone could jump off those wooden ties to the ground. And
you had to. I mean, it's sort of, in a way, it's refreshing a memory and also resurrecting a memory, because you may not have, you know, whatever it's become, your mind is taken back to what it was. And you then, as a writer, make the choice of, well, maybe I should just update my memory. Or, and in some cases, memory is such a wonderfully wicked thing that what you trust as your memory winds up not being true.
Well, so many people who write memoirs, they talk about the fact that the people who are in their families that are written about say, oh, that's not the way it was, or that's not me, or
yeah.
How dare you write that? So with fiction, you have ultimate liberty.
Freedom.
You have total freedom.
Yeah, the freedom we were talking about learning, growing up in Old Town.
And now, by the way, can I just say that I
say
used
anything.
To outrun it's you? I could beat you in a race. Over and over again, I did.
Really?
Yes, I did.
Well, you should have
we
put
were
that,
12.
You should put that in
I
your,
should have put that on the back cover.
Put it in your author's note.
Yes.
My God. And then again, I used to beat Rick Hogan in a race. I was fast, too.
You were, but not
well,
that
I'm sorry
fast.
You didn't want to be in the Olympics then. Richard, the father, is gone. Mona is at home with her mom, who is Liza, and her little daughter, who is Lola, right?
Right.
Lola's real little.
Yeah.
Three.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is she kind of... The other fascinating thing about Mona, and I think it's true of you, too, she's like a photography nut, right?
Right. I love photography. And so I had a chance to read a lot on photography, look at just unending images. And there is a nod paid to Vivian Meyer in this book.
Sure.
The woman who lives next door that Mona takes a preoccupation about because she sees her going out in this old coat, taking a camera with her. And I used the list of cameras that Vivian Meyer had in the book and gave them to this woman. But I didn't want to say she was Vivian Meyer because
yeah, no,
that becomes a whole responsibility.
Oh, no question.
Right.
And there are enough frankly, there are enough books about Vivian Maier out there to satisfy any fan of Vivian Maier's. See, it's wonderful, and what you people are listening to is the way an author's mind works. It is this wonderfully wicked combination of memory and stories heard and snatches of conversation. And, you know, I'm not saying Mona is the 17-year-old Lisa Haynes, but there's something about that, too, because I remember the 17-year-old Lisa Haynes. Yeah, there are not enough sprinting contests in the book for my mind. We're trying to tell you about When We Disappear without giving away too much of it. I have told you that it's in the two voices of Richard, the sort of absent father. Can we say why he's absent?
Well, he loses his job, so the idea is that the pretext is that he's gone off to another state. But you can also feel, because he gets involved in carnival culture, circus culture, through this uncle of his, that he really wants to just escape.
Yeah, that is.
And he doesn't even say goodbye to the family. He just takes off early in the morning.
That's how the book begins. He shut off the alarm clocks, loaded his car, used his handbrake out, and back down the drive without turning the engine over. Richard, my father, was probably in Indiana by now. He had tossed his house keys on the counter as if he wouldn't be back. An envelope was propped on the kitchen table with the letter written to Liz, my mother. That's a very, very good beginning. We're going to talk a little bit more about the book when we come back after a short, short commercial break. And I will read you a little portion of one of Mona's chapters. We'll be right back. It's Alan Barkus, and that's a good philosophy for anybody out there. I have a few more minutes, maybe 10 minutes more, with Lisa Haynes talking about her latest novel, When We Disappear, a great deal of which is set in Chicago. I just read you a portion earlier set in Newark, New Jersey, where the poor dad, Richard, is scrambling. This goes to, Lisa was talking about, you know, being up in Rogers Park, an area of Rogers Park that we used to call the jungle. It could be a tough area. But here, Mona, the 17-year-old in the book, one of the two main voices in the book, has been hitchhiking. And she says, this guy who kept looking over at me like he wasn't sure I was sitting there in the car took me north. Along the way, I felt dizzy and my stomach clenched. I asked him to drop me off at the cemetery. He took me right there without asking for directions. Some people have a way of finding death. The lake was iced over, and the only sound came from the cars fleeing around the curve. Looking across the gravestones and mausoleums, I saw some half-finished repair work. No one in sight, only a slow van on its way out of the main gate. In the warmer seasons, the waves pounded against the limestone break on the other side of Sheridan, and mist comes off the lawn as the morning temperatures shift. There have been reports of seeing an aviator out in the lake. The aviator has a routine where he struggles to stay afloat, but ultimately drowns. Then his ghost hauls itself up out of the water, crosses Sheridan, and enters the cemetery where it disappears. Ghosts are all over this book, Lisa Haynes, aren't they?
And memories are ghosts, right?
Yeah.
And Mona has a really hard time staying within herself.
Yes.
Because she also, like the father, has fled to Newark. She's trying to flee from the things that have happened in her life. And so she does some what we call astral traveling. She gets out of her body at night. She sleepwalks. She feels like she's actually entering somebody else's body. It's not something I'm trying to prove or that she could say this actually happened, but it's that odd feeling you get at times.
Well, you do I'm not giving anything away here by saying that something quite similar to that, which I find maybe a little ambiguous, happens at the very, very, very end of the book. You have not gotten any, the book is just out, you have not gotten any reviews yet because the book is just out and very few people even review books books these days. What are your hopes for this book? I think this would be a remarkable movie, and I guess every author in the world would go, hey, that'd be great. Yeah, send me the check.
I think everybody hopes that they'll get a wide readership, that people will be passionate about the book as much as the author is. But I love the idea of a movie. I'm a movie-holic.
Yeah.
As well as photography, and so I had a deal with HBO for my last book, Girl in the Arena, and they wrote the pilot and so on, but it just,
it's a movie business.
Just don't happen sometimes.
What did your daughter, Sienna, think of this book?
Oh, she's very connected. She often gives me advice on my work. If I get into a stuck place, I'll say, well, I've got my characters here and there, and what do you think? And she will often come up with an answer. She came up with an answer to the end of Girl in the Arena for me.
Yeah.
Now, I guess I better start putting her on the dole, right? More on the dole, right?
Is she on the dole now?
Well, when you get through college. But she's through college now. So.
Well, but she has made your website. She has made the website. She created the website.
And she's over at WGBH now doing gaming.
Sounds
in the children's division.
She's a nice kid. LisaHaines.com is the website, and the way to spell it is LisaHaines.com. You can be very proud of this book, and do your students, obviously your students know who you are and what you do. How does that affect the rhythm of the class? Are the best students are the ones who are really, struggling for A's, go out and say, oh, Ms. Haynes, I loved your novel. I read it in one sitting overnight.
Well, you get a couple of people like that. I try and make it about their work. And if they've read something, and I always like to read the authors that I was working with.
Yeah.
So it's nice when they do that. But it's really about who they are and what their voice is about.
We're trying to round this out perfectly. We talked about where we grew up and some of the influences we had, parental influences.
Yes.
What writers have influenced you most profoundly? I know that can change with every decade or every new book. Or are there some that have just really, really helped you find your foundation as a writer?
Boy, there's so many. I think one of the modern writers that I like is Lily Tuck, the woman who walked on water, the woman who shot a man. Laurie Moore.
Sure.
I'm big on her.
Poets, too, because you were,
except when I wanted to shift from poetry to fiction, I stopped reading poets.
Wow.
Very intentionally. It was hard because I had worked with a number of poets.
Sure.
But I just said, that's it. If I'm ever going to learn how to write fiction, I have to disconnect from the form.
Yeah. I remember some of your poetry, which I read, and it was good.
Yeah. Okay.
It was good. Was that a hard thing to give up?
No, because I suddenly thought, novels to me felt like, oh, three-dimensional chess. This is fascinating. It's like, oh, hey, I think I'll go out and be a brain surgeon. So it was too much fun.
In Emerson, do you have a community out there of writers with which you hang out? Certainly not the same here as it was years and years ago. And, people, I don't know what they do. They sit at home and watch TV.
Yeah, we have Penn New England, which is a wonderful organization. You can go to a reading any night of the week, and you'll probably see someone you know.
Wow.
We all try and support each other as much as we can. So.
That's great.
Yeah.
And you spent some time, just to finish this whole thing off, at Ragdale, which is
this
extraordinary kind of writer's colony in Lake Forest.
And there was a ghost in my room.
What was the name?
I can't remember her name, but I saw her in the
window. Do women always think of dream of men ghosts and vice versa?
Oh, now that I don't know.
But that's what those guys, Josh Knoll, who's my next guest and a colleague of mine, will find it. I don't know if you did anything at Printer's Row, but Lisa was two other authors. Tell that story again. There, two other authors, and the topic was...
Right, Rana Reiko Rizzuto and Julia Fine, and Amy Danzer ran the group, and it was about female desire.
And two guys were in the room. The room was packed, loaded with people. And after like 5 minutes or so, they're like, oh, man, we're not learning nothing about female desires.
These
are a couple like broad authors, man. What are we doing here? That basically was it.
Right.
Were they embarrassed to walk out?
No.
They should have been embarrassed to be there.
Right.
Lisa Haynes, it is a remarkable thing to have known you low these many years, even if you did beat me racing when we were young.
Let's do it a few more decades, okay?
I'm not going to go out and race you on Michigan Avenue. It's kind of empty out there. Yeah, let's do it a few more decades, honey. When We Disappear is her latest novel. You should have all of her work on your shelf. Go to lisahaynes.com to do that. Love you.
Love you, too.
All right, sweetheart. All right. We'll be right back.